So this afternoon I'd like to explore in a bit more detail the second noble truth, the truth of the cause of suffering. And as Gil mentioned yesterday, the cause of suffering is really tied up with our relationship to experience. It is within our relationship to experience that this cause of suffering, the wanting, is found. So generally with things happening, there's a serious set of things happening, and we either want them to be some other way that they're not, or we want them to stay a particular way. We want something to happen. We want something to stop happening. We want to control, to fix, to change, to manipulate the world so that it conforms to what we think we'd like. So when we want things to be the way we want them to be, when we have this movement to manipulate, to control, to fix, to change, organize our world, whether we want to either have what we like or get rid of what we don't like, either we may be unsuccessful in that, and in that case it's pretty obvious why this wanting is suffering. If we want something to be other than it is and we're not able to make it otherwise, we suffer. There's frustration, there's a sense of perhaps anger or fear for not being able to have the world be the way we'd like it to be. But if we are successful, if we manage to either change things and get what we like, or somehow magically the world provides what we like, why is that suffering? That doesn't seem so obvious to us that kind of wanting would be suffering. I wanted that thing, I got it, I'm happy. What's the problem? Well, there's a couple reasons why it's I don't know if the right word is a problem, but that's the one that comes to my mind at the moment. The first most obvious reason why that kind of wanting leads to suffering is because the thing that we think is making us happy, that kind of happiness that results from that kind of wanting, is not very lasting. It changes pretty quickly. So we make all this effort, we manipulate, we control, we maneuver, and we get something, and then it lasts for a short time. And we may, in the getting what we want, in the getting what we actually want, there may be a sense of, okay, I've got it now. And in that having, there may be a feeling of a little bit of fear of, is it going to go away? Is somebody going to take it from me? How can I keep this thing? So there's that kind of agitation around the keeping once we've gotten something that we want. So that's a way that the getting what we want is a kind of dukkha, a kind of stress. It may not be what we call suffering, but there's the stress of having to maintain what we have gotten. So we're kind of conditioned in a way to react to the things of the world. And it's in this reaction, in this wanting and not wanting, that the direct cause of our suffering lies, the direct cause of our stress. There's all kinds of conditions that come together to create a stressful situation. But it's kind of the Buddha pinpointed this wanting, the craving, as being the kind of most fundamental, like, linchpin that holds the suffering together or kind of puts it into motion. So, since this reactivity is something that happens in our minds, it's kind of optional. And this is the good news, because it means that there's the possibility that we can change, or that there's the opportunity to change our minds. And the path, the way to change our minds, the mind-changing path, is the Noble Eightfold Path. So our culture actually encourages this kind of wanting, this craving that we kind of habitually engage in. The message we get from the time we're pretty small, not only from our own experience, but from what people tell us, what our parents tell us, what we hear on TV, is that if we get what we want, we'll be happy. That having what you want is the source of happiness. A recent example of this. Satisfy your cravings. In a Rite Aid ad. If you happen to be craving M&M's, Hershey bars, Fritos, or macaroni and cheese, this has your answer. Satisfy your cravings. In some ways, we are... Do you know the story of the monkey trap? Do you know about the monkey trap? It's said that in tropical countries where there are a lot of monkeys, if you want to catch a monkey, you take a coconut, and you hollow it out and create, you know, just the shell, and then put a slit in that coconut and put some sweets inside of it. And then you just put it out there. You attach the coconut to something with a rope, tie it to a tree or something. And then you just sit there and wait. And the monkey will come up to this and sniff around and think it smells good and there's something in there, and it knows it can see it can get its hand in that little slit. So it gets its hand in that little slit, and it grabs the sweets, but you've made the slit small enough so that it can't get its hand out of the coconut. And you can go then and basically pick up the monkey, because the monkey is so attached to the idea of the sweets, to having the sweets, that it can't let go of the sweets. We're like that. We're holding on to satisfying our cravings. And it's a trap. It's trapping us into this kind of like hamster wheel, endless cycle of wanting, wanting, wanting. And all it really takes is the letting go. If that monkey could just let go, it could run away before the person would come and trap it. Trapped by its own wanting. And that's the way our wanting functions. partly, we not only have been told that when we get what we want, we'll be happy, but we've experienced this over and over in our lives. We get what we want at some, you know, from the time we're very young, we get what we want. We notice that when we've gotten what we want, it feels good. When we get rid of something we don't want, it feels good to not have that thing in our space anymore. There's a feeling of, I can control things, and my environment is more pleasant now. So in this process of getting what we want, it's kind of like a double hit of pleasant in a way, because in the process of getting what we want, we get a little bit of pleasantness of the thing that we want, and we also get the pleasantness of the wanting going away. And as I mentioned the other day, that's a very powerful force. The vast majority, actually, of the sense of dissatisfaction in our wanting, and a large share of the happiness that comes from getting what we want, is the fact that the wanting goes away. It's not as much the actual getting what we want. So this reinforcement of our, I get what I want, it feels good, happening over and over again to us, we start to believe that the only way to have the satisfaction, or the only way towards the happiness, is to get what we want. So this is a very powerful force in our lives. And this process of the getting what we want and the releasing of the feeling of wanting combined with the getting what we want happening over and over again. And we get what we want, we get that thing, and you know, the happiness lasts for a little while. And then there's kind of a sense of, as that happiness fades, there's a sense of, I want more of that. And we go out looking for where we can get more of that. So sometimes we can even create wantings. What do I want to want? So this puts us into a kind of a cycle of compulsive wanting. A perpetuation, that the having what we want kind of reinforces this cycle. The having what we want and the letting go of that wanting reinforces, I want more of that so I can feel more of that. So this is perpetual cycle. This is a description of, to me, it sounds like a description of this perpetual cycle. It's a poem by Rilke. But tell me, who are they, these wanderers, even more transient than we ourselves, who from their earliest days are savagely wrung out by a never satisfied will? For whose sake? Yet it wrings them, bends them, twists them, swings them and flings them, and catches them again, and falling as if through oiled, slippery air, they land on the threadbare carpet, worn constantly thinner by their perpetual leaping. The never-satisfied will and the perpetual leaping. That's the trap that we are caught in. So the Buddha recognized that the form of happiness that comes from satisfying our craving, from satisfying our wants, is not actually very satisfying. It's so short-lived, it's fleeting, and it keeps us tied to this cycle of just endlessly grasping, the perpetual leaping. And he realized that a deeper happiness results from the letting go of the wanting. This is the action that the Buddha suggested with respect to the second noble truth. Let go of the craving. So this idea of letting go, from the perspective of the belief that satisfying our craving is what creates happiness, letting go of the craving seems counterintuitive. Why would I want to let go of this thing? Satisfying is what makes me happy. And if I let go of my wanting, won't there just be this endless emptiness? It sometimes feels like the want or wantings is what defines us. So it kind of takes a leap of faith to try this. Here on retreat, you have a great opportunity to explore this. Try it and see. There are many little subtle wantings that happen throughout your day. In my own experience, a lot of those seem to happen around the meals. And sometimes they happen elsewhere. On one retreat, a three-month retreat I was on, I was doing a lot of walking meditation outside. It was a fall in New England, and I was doing walking meditation outside. And I began to notice that I had this really strong desire to look at people while I was doing the walking meditation. People would be walking by doing their own thing. And I had this strong want, this desire to look at them. And I had been instructed that you should, you know, kind of restrain your senses, not look around too much, just kind of keep your eyes, you know, maybe 4 feet in front of you on the ground while you're doing walking meditation. And so that's what I was doing. I was just kind of forcing myself to not look. It was kind of like, I'm going to be a good yogi. I'm going to do what I'm told. I'm not going to look. Just putting the blinders on and not looking. After some time of this, I finally got the idea. It's like I finally realized, oh, this is wanting. I had been so focused on the instruction of don't look around you that I hadn't really noticed that this was wanting. And I finally realized, well, okay, if wanting is what's happening, rather than trying to force myself to not want and to, you know, kind of, you know, just force myself into the lifting, moving, placing, lifting, moving, placing, not going to look, not going to look, lifting, not going to look, not going to look. Rather than doing that, instead I got the idea maybe I should actually observe the wanting. So I began doing that. I began exploring the wanting, exploring this process of the wanting. And what I discovered was that as I was walking back and forth, I was still not looking. So I wasn't acting on the walking, but wanting, but instead of just kind of, I was trying to deny it. I was trying to push it away before, when I was just, you know, focused on the walking. And I finally realized, no, I'm going to actually pay attention. What does it feel like? And it felt like this magnetic pull. It was actually kind of hard not to follow through. It's just like this pull to, you know, it's like somebody comes into my field of vision. It's like, you know, get pulled over to look at them. And I didn't look. Instead, I just felt the feeling. And I got kind of familiar with that feeling of that, just feeling of wanting is not a pleasant feeling. So that's a lesson for us, actually, that when we start to recognize the feeling of wanting itself, often that unpleasantness of the wanting itself is masked because we're so focused on the getting the thing that we want. So in the not looking, in the just feeling it, I began to really experience the unsatisfactoriness, the unsatisfactory feeling of wanting itself. And this was a 3-month retreat, so I got to do this for a long time. I eventually began to recognize that that feeling of wanting would begin, it would arise, when somebody popped into my peripheral vision. Before that, there was no wanting. Nobody in my field of vision, no wanting. Somebody, boop, wanting comes in. So I began to understand the wanting as being dependent on causes. And watching the process of wanting, as long as that person, even though I didn't look at them, you know, you've got peripheral vision, so I could kind of see them. I could feel that pull, that magnetic pull towards that person. Maybe walking up that way, and then in front of me, and then up the stairs into the building, and the wanting disappears. Person disappeared, the wanting disappeared. This is that, you know, this is that letting go of the vice grip kind of feeling I described the other day. It really just felt like poof, released. The wanting disappeared. And the suffering disappeared. The feeling of being not satisfied disappeared when the wanting disappeared. And for a while, I kind of got into this. This was, it was like fun to watch the, it got fun, actually, to watch the wanting. I really, it was enjoyable to see, particularly to see it disappear. That was particularly fun. And at some point, I realized that I was actually hanging on to the wanting because I was so interested in watching it disappear. So there was one point where I was watching somebody and feeling the wanting, and I realized I was holding on to the wanting in order to watch it disappear when they left. And in that moment of that recognition, the wanting disappeared. I realized that there was a wanting of the wanting, and a wanting to see the disappearance. And that moment was kind of a turning point for me in the retreat, because after that point, that wanting to look at other people just vanished. So retreats offer a great opportunity. These are really harmless wantings. Let yourself explore the feeling, wanting to see how much food somebody else is taking. Wanting to go back for thirds. Let yourself just explore the feeling. See how long it lasts. Another interesting place to explore this is in your sitting practice. If there's something that, you know, some itch or some physical sensation that makes you feel like you want to move, explore that feeling of wanting to move. Don't scratch the itch. Don't move. See how long that feeling of wanting lasts. It'll probably dissipate. It may dissipate and even vanish for a short time, and then it might come back. So watch this process of wanting. Actually get familiar with that feeling of that pull. And when it has come and gone 3 times, then you can let yourself move or let yourself scratch. You play with it in this way, you know, to see. Get familiar with this feeling of wanting. Having a sense of curiosity and interest about it is really helpful. Because we often in this feeling, the feeling of wanting, it feels so off in a way. You know, it just feels so yucky when we really turn to it. That, again, it can feel kind of counterintuitive to spend time in the space of that wanting, that feeling of wanting. But having a curiosity about what puts it together, how does it fall apart, can support. It's sometimes we think that the idea is to get rid of the wanting, but it's really to begin to understand it. And in that understanding, we'll start to see that this letting be of the wanting, in the letting be, in the just observing, it begins to let go of itself. So the obvious kind of craving, the most obvious kind of craving that we have is for sense pleasure, things in the world, you know, wanting things to be comfy, wanting things to be pleasant, liking our food, wanting to get rid of things that feel sharp or irritating or annoying. You know, the kind of the world of sense pleasure is a huge field for craving. This is kind of the most obvious area to explore it in. And there's some more subtle and more perhaps complex kinds of craving. We also sometimes crave a feeling or a sense of being a certain kind of person, being a craving for a certain identity. We want to be a respected person, or we want to be a successful person. We want to be seen, heard, in a certain way by other people. So we want to try to control and manipulate our environment so that we have that identity. We also have some identities or some identities that we've actually taken on at some level. We've taken on identities that we want to get rid of, that we don't like. Sometimes, you know, we have the feeling that we're a failure, that we're not capable of something. And in really identifying with that, we don't want that. We want that identity to go away. So in terms of craving identities, we essentially want the pleasure that comes with an idea of a certain identity. And the pleasure, some of it turns into the pleasure of the sense field of having people admire us or give us nice things or something like that. That, you know, the craving for identity and the craving for sense pleasure can be intertwined in this way. So we want the pleasure that comes with the having some identities, and we want to get rid of the unpleasantness that comes with the with having other identities, the ones we want to get rid of. In my own practice, I have explored this area of identity around wanting to be a good yogi, wanting to feel like a good yogi, wanting to be perceived as a good yogi, wanting people to think I'm a good, not only think I'm a good yogi, but know I'm a good yogi, to have the teachers think I'm a good yogi. All of this, it was a huge kind of a wanting around that. I really wanted to be seen in that way. And there were times when I found it so difficult to be mindful that I would realize, or there would be some part of me that would go, well, I'm not a good yogi. And I would take on that identity. And I began to see that there were some thoughts going on around both of these identities. That when I felt like I was measuring up to my own idea of whatever I thought good yogi was, I would tell myself, I'm a good yogi. I can do this. And when I felt that I was having trouble, that I was struggling, I would notice thoughts like, I'm a failure. I failed. I'm no good. I really didn't like that identity. I really wanted to get rid of that identity. And initially there was this kind of movement towards really paying attention. So I was noticing the identification with feeling like a failure. And began paying careful attention to those thoughts. And I actually at one point noticed it would alternate, like within a split second. I would, oh, I'm a failure. And then I put my foot down and I would notice that I could feel the sensation of my foot. Oh, I'm a good yogi. I can feel the sensation of my foot. And then something else, oh, I'm a failure. And at some point in this alternation, I began to see that the identification with being a good yogi, that kind of setup, that kind of, I hadn't really questioned that that was a problem. You know, that craving, that was the way it was supposed to be. And at some point I realized that that identity that I was holding myself up to, that kind of believing that I had to be something, this good yogi, whatever that is, that was the setup for the feeling like I was a failure. And that what I really needed to do was not pay so much attention. I mean, I kept noticing, of course, all of the thoughts and whatever around the identity of being a failure. But it was actually more important for me to really, really recognize with mindfulness when I was propping myself up. I'm a good yogi. That's just a thought. What does that feel like? So really noticing the kind of that craving for that identity and the whole ramification of that craving. So that craving for that identity and the clinging to that identity essentially set me up for the failure. So this kind of thing, if you find that there's a sense of, you know, some polarities in your experience of the good identity and the bad identity, if you've got those in your mind, it may be that it's interesting to explore or question whether there's a need to hold on to that, what we might call a positive identity. So the Buddha said that craving causes suffering. And since that exploration is fruitful with respect to looking at how our suffering comes to be, it can also be interesting to look at what are the causes that support craving. What makes craving come to be? When the Buddha woke up on the night of his awakening, on the night of his enlightenment, he had a deep, penetrating insight into the causes of suffering, stated in terms of both the Four Noble Truths and in terms of a teaching called the Teaching of Dependent Origination. This is a chain. The chain of dependent origination is a chain of 12 steps that the Buddha saw lead us from the contact of our experience in the world into suffering. So that not only does craving lead us into suffering, but there are things that lead us into craving. So I'm not going to go through the whole teaching of dependent origination, but I do want to mention a couple of parts of this teaching. So the Buddha pointed out that, you know, we have a mind and a body, this kind of field of mind and body and our sense bases, our sense doors, the six sense bases of our five physical sense bases plus the mind, seeing, smelling, hearing, tasting, touching, plus the mind, that because of that physical mental continuum, we experience contact coming in from the world. We see sights, we hear sounds, we smell smells, we think thoughts, we experience thoughts. So there's contact with the world. With every one of those contacts, whether it's a sight, a sound, a smell, a taste, a touch, or something arising in our mind, with every single one of those contacts, there is a feeling tone associated with it. It's either pleasant, it's unpleasant, or it's neither pleasant nor unpleasant. It's neutral. And so based on that feeling that everything has, we generally, in a kind of very natural and normal way, we tend to like what's pleasant. So there's something pleasant in our world, we like it. We want it. We think we need it. We go to get it. We grasp onto it. Something unpleasant in our world, we don't like it. We don't want it. We hate it. We have to get rid of it. So the feeling, feeling tone, the pleasant, unpleasant, neutral, is said to be condition for this craving. This is a kind of the thing that's in close proximity to the craving is this feeling. So feeling leads to craving kind of naturally, and you can see this even in animals and see it in children and even in little single-celled creatures that kind of move towards what would be food and away from noxious chemicals. You know, it's kind of very deep in our system to go towards what's pleasant and away from what's unpleasant. But the wanting, the craving that comes after it, which seems to happen fairly naturally, is not necessary. So feeling conditions craving, but it's not absolutely, it doesn't necessarily follow. Feeling, craving doesn't necessarily follow from feeling. So there must be something else operating if craving doesn't necessarily follow from feeling. And that something else operating is ignorance. It's a misunderstanding. And there's different ways that this ignorance operates to have feeling lead into craving. But one of the key ways, or one of the easy ways to look at it, goes back to how we think we find happiness. We think we find happiness by satisfying our cravings. So we kind of misunderstand where happiness lies. And in that misunderstanding, we think that craving will lead us to happiness. So since this feeling tone is kind of the proximate link in the chain, the Buddha actually points to understanding feeling as being a very helpful tool in letting go of craving. That when we understand how feeling functions and how the linkage between the feeling and craving, that our mind begins to get retuned and retrained. So contemplating feeling tone, getting familiar with it, getting familiar with pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral, which happens in every moment of our experience. It's a subtle feeling. It's a subtle experience. But once we start to kind of attune to it and get a sense of how valuable it is to pay attention to it, it kind of can be highlighted for us. I mean, once we're kind of attuned to this notion of pleasant, unpleasant, neutral, it's pretty obvious that, for me at least, chocolate ice cream is pleasant. It's pretty obvious that a painful bruise, if I fall down and hurt my knee, that it's unpleasant. So the attunement to this quality of pleasant, unpleasant, neutral, it just can sometimes just kind of take a little shift in the mind to just start to begin to recognize that it's happening all the time. So, you know, in your yogi jobs, just begin to notice. You know, if you're a dishwasher, noticing what's pleasant and unpleasant about that experience. You know, perhaps the stickiness of food is unpleasant. The warmth of the water is pleasant. Just beginning to track that quality and beginning to see how, as we track, beginning to become familiar with this quality of pleasant, unpleasant, neutral, we can begin to see how it so quickly leads into, ooh, liking, wanting, needing. The compulsion part of that craving comes in. So, again, the point of the exploration is to begin to understand this process, to begin to understand how these processes are put together. And that understanding itself begins to dismantle itself in a way. And that if we can be, when we can sort of be fully present for the feeling, sometimes it can short-circuit the movement to the wanting. So that if we can just be present for, oh yeah, this is pleasant. Pleasantness is happening right now. And really just meet that experience of pleasantness, wanting may not arise. It's just, oh, this is an experience of pleasantness right now. Oh, here's an experience of unpleasantness right now. We start to see how quickly it changes, the impermanent nature of feeling. It's very rapidly changing, fleeting, this quality of feeling. So, pay attention when you're chewing your food, for instance, particularly if it's something you like, a piece of food that you like. Where's the pleasantness in it? How long does it last? And how much of the pleasantness that you attribute to that has to do with a sense of anticipation? Of wanting, essentially. So just getting familiar with feeling and the process by which feeling leads to craving. Not that any of this is wrong or bad. This is the way our minds have been habituated to behave. And we are investigating our minds. And as we do this investigation, we start to see that kind of leaving our minds alone, instead of acting on these wantings, slowly over time, these wantings begin to shrivel. So the last kind of exploration I'll make around the second noble truth around craving is to explore kind of idea we have around suffering, that we kind of have this idea sometimes around our suffering that particularly habitual kinds of suffering, you know, ones that kind of revisit us over and over again, we sometimes feel like they're kind of baggage that we always have with us. And what I'd like to point to is actually that suffering, the stress, the suffering, and its cause happen in the present moment. There are causes and conditions from the past that have led us into a particular situation that we're in right now. But it is our relationship to this moment that determines whether we suffer or not. So, you know, we might be suffering over something that happened in the past. And what's actually happening if we're suffering over something that's happening in the past? There's a thought that's happening in the mind. In the present moment, a memory is happening in the present moment. And we're suffering over that memory. Likewise with the future. We have some idea about what might happen in the future. We come up with some construction of what possibly might happen. Maybe 18 scenarios of what might happen. And we suffer over the idea that is being generated here and now in the moment. The thought of the future is happening here in the present moment. There isn't actually that future out there somewhere. It is an idea in our mind here in the present moment. So the thought of the past is one thing, and our reaction to it is another. So I'll give an example about this. Suppose in the past, a friend betrayed you. There was a feeling of being a loss of trust with that friend. And so that happened, say, a year and a half ago. And you're still, in some way, suffering over that betrayal. So what happens when that suffering happens? I mean, in my own experience, the way I've felt this before I really started observing my own mind was that I was really carrying that suffering with me all the time. It felt like, it came up so often, it must be always there. It must just always be there. But what actually happens is that thing happened a long time ago, and at some point, a memory in your mind appears, perhaps an unrelated memory about that friend. And then you recall what they did to you. And then you want it to not be that way. So the craving comes in. You want the past to be different. You want it to not be that way. And in that moment, then, the anger, the feeling of betrayal is recreated. It's regenerated. So in a sense, there is a way in which that baggage that we think we carry with us. There's a kind of a way it's there. There's a proclivity, there's a habituated tendency, a kind of a tendency to fall into that pattern. But when that pattern, that tendency isn't in effect, the suffering of that pattern isn't there. So it's kind of like, you know, we're kind of carrying the baggage with us, but it's floating beside us, and it only is hard when we actually pick it up, you know, so that the weight of that suffering is only there when we choose to engage in it. So the thought of the friend and the reaction to that thought, kind of in a series of steps, takes us from the thought to the reaction again. They're two different things, the thought arising of the friend and the reaction to the thought. And it's possible over time, through just simply witnessing, observing, particularly with kind of habitual patterns, just keeping on witnessing these patterns over and over again, you might begin to recognize the distinction between the thoughts and the reactions to the thought in the present moment. So suffering and its cause happen now, happen in the present moment. And it's possible to dismantle it in the present moment. There's an understanding about the way the brain works that I feel really helped me to kind of see this, how this kind of works. There's a kind of a common phrase that neurons that fire together wire together. So, you know, if this thought of your friend and the subsequent anger happen together a lot, they kind of get really tightly intertwined. You know, the cells or the pattern of neuronal firings that contains the memory and the pattern of neuronal firings that lead to anger become linked. They become tied together. And so that's why it feels like there's almost no option, you know, for when that thought of that friend comes up, for the anger to come up with it. But the additional bit that I found so interesting in this understanding of how the brain works is that when you're not engaging that pattern, you know, that pattern between the anger and the memory, then if you're not engaging that pattern, then essentially if you don't engage it long enough, the neurons start to decide, I mean, we can give a little bit of agency to the neurons. The neurons start to decide that this is not a useful pattern to be supporting anymore, and so they start to wither. Now, the way of paying attention to our experience with mindfulness, of just meeting our emotional experience, of feeling the craving, of feeling the anger with mindfulness and not acting on it, seems to, in our brains somehow, it doesn't keep supporting those neuronal connections to wire together. It in fact supports them to come apart. That mindfulness of anger doesn't actually engage those circuits. It kind of allows them to do their thing while they're doing their thing. But you're actually engaging other circuits in your brain, other areas of your brain that allow that pattern to kind of begin to dissipate. So mindfulness actually begins to allow these neuronal connections to wither, to fall apart. When I heard that, I kind of thought, wow, you know, that's the craving. It's like almost those neuronal connections tied together, kind of like the craving in a way. And the mindfulness is what allows it to begin to dissipate. And the pattern there of the linkage between the thought and the friend and that pattern of anger being linked together. That's that baggage that we carry around. But it's not, when it's not operating, the baggage is getting lighter because the neurons are not engaging together. So for me, it was kind of helpful to reflect on it in this way. I don't know if it is for you, but the real pointer here is to bringing mindfulness rather than reactivity to our experience. Turning our attention towards experience with as little reactivity as possible, with as much equanimity, as much balance of mind. The how of our experience, as Gil was talking about. And if we see that there is reactivity in that how, and a lot of our craving is found in that how, that place of how we're relating to experience, that's really where the craving is born. So if we can meet even that how of experience with balance of mind, to not react to our reactions, slowly over time, they start to gradually wear away, like a rope that's sitting out in the sun, on the sand, on the beach, just slowly getting rotted away over time. That craving falls apart. So let's sit for a moment.